I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1,000 points as nervous investors rushed to sell off their stocks. There are a number of factors making them jittery, including China. Its stock market has tumbled, its once booming economy is slowing down, and it has devalued its currency. That's a triple threat that has global implications. Today, stocks in China fell about 8%. I'm looking over my shoulder at our TV station here, our TV set here, seeing that the stock market is down almost 500 points, and it's just 10 o'clock in the morning. Let me introduce our two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio, Jacques Delisle, professor of law, also professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, Deputy Director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China. And Jacques Delisle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Mauro Guillen. He's a professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Joseph H. Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. And Mauro Guillen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Mauro, if I could. It feels like 2008, 2009, all over again. Are we looking at something like that?
Well, hopefully not. Looking at the numbers from last week and this week in the United States, this is, you know, probably an overdue correction, hopefully, rather than, the beginning of another, you know, global event. But, of course, what's going on in China, what's going on in Europe, what's going on in other parts of the world is worrisome, and we should pay attention to it.
But do you think China is driving this, or is it a combination of factors?
It's a combination of factors, but China looms large because it is the second largest economy in the world and the world's largest trading nation.
To you, Jacques, when did China's problems, I mean, can we put it that, when did China's problems begin?
Well, the stuff we've seen, of course, is the stock market tumble, which is down 38% from the peak. But that's after a big, big run-up. I mean, it's still above where it was when the run-up started a little over a year ago. So it's a huge hit, but, you know, compared to what? I think the bigger concern is not so much the stock market crash per se. It's what it tells us about underlying features of the Chinese economy and the government's policy response. And then there are downstream effects about the confidence of Chinese investors and consumers and how that spreads. But the underlying concerns about the Chinese economy go way, way back. And indeed, many of the reforms that the new leadership announced, that the Xi Jinping leadership that came to power a few years ago announced a year or two into their rule, to shift more toward markets, both domestically and in terms of currency and such, those are meant to correct problems that have been there a long, long time. So it's always hard to tell why problems erupt into the news and have an impact in any given moment. But there's a real sense everywhere, I think, that although the Chinese economy is still doing very well by world standards, it's still doing 7% or so, we think, but that's way down from what it has been. And the question was how to adjust to a new normal of lower growth and how to keep even that lower growth rate going.
Well, what explains that lower growth rate? Is it that you can't maintain a growth rate of 10 or 12% forever, that at some point it's going to correct itself?
Yeah, it would be kind of like defying the laws of gravity. I mean, economies don't grow at that rate for decades and decades. And a lot of what fueled Chinese growth has been expended. So part of it was getting people out of agriculture and into higher productivity work in urban industry. But a lot of that transformation has occurred. Right. Part of China's growth was undercutting cost on production. So that's why China became the workshop of the world. The problem is wages have gone up, partly because workers have demanded it, partly because the regime wanted to deliver that to its people. But now there are cheaper countries, and some of that production has moved to them. And part of it is China has had to a significant degree an export-led growth strategy. And you can't grow at 10, 12, 14% relying heavily on exports if you're already the world's second largest economy. The numbers just don't add up, especially when your major importing countries are not consuming at the rate they used to be. And Europe and the U.S. and other developed countries are a big part of the export market.
Well, let me have you pick up on that tomorrow. And what we're seeing, obviously, what happened in China earlier today and then what's happening in Europe, and we don't know what's going to happen in the U.S., but what we see is how interconnected we are.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the last 30 years have been a time of increasing interconnections in terms of money flows, especially money flows, mm-hmm. currencies, but also trade and people movements. And, of course, a minor disturbance in some part of the global economy immediately has reverberations, has effects in a, you know, far-flung country halfway around the world.
But do you see China, from your perspective, do you see China sort of correcting itself, or is this a sign of more systemic problems?
Well, China has been trying for the last 10 years or so to become a different kind of an economy, more driven by consumption as opposed to investment and exports. But it's a very difficult transition to make when for 25 years you've been growing by selling a lot of stuff, cheap stuff, to Europe and the United States primarily. China has also been trying to internationalize its currency, but moving very, very slowly. It has been trying to open up its financial markets, but again, very, very slowly. So it's a country that has made a lot of progress. It's no longer a desperately poor country, but it is not a modern economy in the way in which the European economies or Japan or the United States are.
Well, what's interesting, Jacques, I mean, we are an economy that depends, largely on consumer spending, something about...
It's about two-thirds of GDP or so, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, is that the model that China is looking at?
Well, that's eventually where they're headed in that direction. I mean, the point of economic growth ultimately is to make people's lives better. And China has been engaged in a game of deferred consumption. So consumption is up. But the story was, let's make the economy strong, let's make the country strong, and then eventually the rising tide will lift all boats. There are a couple of issues. One is, as Mauro says, shifting to a consumer economy is tough, especially when you haven't made a bunch of other market transitions. So export-led growth, you can do that by being efficient and by having a currency that's in the range that promotes exports and all that, and by having favorable climates for inbound foreign investment that produces goods for export. And you can do a lot by investment. And China had gigantic infrastructure needs. It still does. But a lot of that money hasn't been spent efficiently, and there are reasons for that. Basically, local officials are evaluated on the basis of how the local GDP is doing, how the local economy is going. And when you build a building, that counts toward your short-term economic activity, even if nobody ever moves into it. So the incentives are a little perverse. People move on to other posts. By the time it all catches up, the relevant officials have moved on. So getting out of that kind of thing, which you can do with policy, into one by consumers, an economy based on consumers, is a little tough. And this China has called the rebalancing effort, and it's been on the agenda for years. It's been relatively slow to happen. And part of what you see with things like the devaluation and with what we saw in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis as well is a tendency for the government to reintervene when things are going badly. So what do you do if you come in and prop up the stock market, if you come in and devalue in effect? And it's interesting, and I wanted to hear what Mauro says about this. We talk about this not as a currency drop in markets. We talk about this as a devaluation. That's the kind of thing you do with a managed controlled rate. It's not something that happens in the market. So although the market pressure was downward, it is significant that we talk about this as a policy choice rather than something that happens in currency markets.
You want to pick up on that? I mean, the question is when you, I guess, devalue the currency, are you manipulating it? What's the correct word we should use here?
Well, the Chinese currency is not freely traded in the markets. It's not convertible. It is, its price relative to other currencies is set by the government. And therefore, I think it is fair to say that there is manipulation of it as opposed to market forces, determining its value. I think it's important about the devaluation of August 11th is that it didn't come alone. They also changed the way in which the renminbi exchange rate is going to be set from now on. So it used to be the case that the state-owned banks in China would tell the government, hey, these are the rates that we have in mind, and they would calculate the average and then try to keep the value of the currency within a certain range of that. But now they've changed the method, and now what they're saying is that they're going to take the exchange rate as of the previous day as the reference rate, and then try to keep
daily fluctuations.
Right.
Then?
So it's a movement towards letting the market set the exchange rate for renminbi. Let's see how this works, because they just announced it on August 11th. But it is a step maybe in the right direction, but you still have the government, the central bank, keeping the value of the currency within a certain range. Right?
One of the things you said to me, Mauro, is make sure you ask us why the currency has two names. So since you said that, I will ask you, why does
the currency? So you want me to answer that?
I do.
So Jacques, who knows Chinese history in and out, can correct me, but essentially the yuan came into being in 1890, right? So
yuan,
so to speak, right?
I mean, it's a colloquial term for unit of currency, the way
that's
we talk about a buck or a dollar, something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. So you buy a coffee for 2 yuan. You don't buy a coffee for 2 renminbi, which is the other. Renminbi is the official name of the currency. So I would say it's the same thing as pound sterling, which is the official name of the British currency, and pounds. So you buy a coffee for 2 pounds. You don't buy a coffee for 2 pounds sterlings, right?
Jacques?
Yeah, and renminbi literally means the people's money. So it's one of these things that came in with the revolution, and it's changed. Maybe the people's money, but it is now hardly equally distributed among the people, which is another question with the consumption issues we were talking about. But I want to pick up on one other thing about this 4.4% move, roughly, right, in the currency. You know, for one day, that's a huge shift. It's the biggest it's happened in many years, and that would be remarkable in any currencies. What's remarkable is how radically it departed from what has been a Chinese trading band of about 0.16% or something. So there's been, you know, minor float, and over time it can build up. But this was a big one-day change. What makes it so ambiguous, and this is what I think Mauro is getting at, is that on the one hand, this is something like manipulation. It's a policy choice to lower the value of the renminbi. But it is a drop that appears to be consistent with where the market pressure was going anyway. So do you read this as a step toward markets, which is right, essential for the Chinese right, goal of making the renminbi a reserve currency? Or is this a goose the economy, goose exports policy intervention? You can read it either way, and that's what makes this so hard.
But who are the winners? When China devalues its currency, who are the winners? Who are the losers?
It's a harder question than it used to be. I mean, some people are clearly losers, right? So people who export things to China are clearly going to have to charge a higher price in renminbi for what they're doing. So commodities exporters, capital goods exporters, U.S. exports to China include a lot of capital goods and some commodities, but, you know, Australia, Brazil, Chile, all those places that send raw materials. The general slowdown of the Chinese economy plus making those things more expensive is going to hurt. Chinese exporters in the short run should do well, but, you know, who exactly are Chinese exporters? A lot of those are foreign invested firms that are producing for export back to developed country markets. And much of what they produce is assembled products that incorporate imported inputs, which are themselves going to be more expensive. So this who wins, who loses, it's not simple a China-U.S. thing. It's good for U.S. consumers in the short run because our goods
cheaper
get cheaper.
Goods.
Right. But it also creates a greater trade deficit and all those problems.
I think what Jacques is saying is really, really important. China has a deficit with three countries, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, and that's because they import a lot of components. So take the iPhone. The iPhone, some estimates indicate that only 10% of the value of the iPhone is added in China. The rest comes from Taiwan, from Japan, from South Korea, even from Germany, all of the components, right? So as Jacques was saying, the net effects of a devaluation of the Chinese currency, it's unclear exactly what effect is going to have, because if only 10% of the value of the iPhone is accounted for by Chinese labor and Chinese components, then, you know, it's unclear what's going to be the net effect, because all of those other components from Japan and from South Korea, from Germany, from Taiwan are going to be more expensive in renminbi terms, right? And then it depends also on where you're selling the iPhone. Are you selling it in the U.S.? Are you selling it in Europe? That's the other issue here, which is, as you know, the dollar has appreciated relative to the euro and other currencies over the last year. But the renminbi has stayed pegged to the dollar for the last year. So the renminbi has been appreciating, actually, for the last year, not relative to the U.S. dollar, but relative to the euro, relative to all of these other currencies, right? So the whole thing, as you mentioned, Marty, at the beginning, is incredibly complex, right? The world is interconnected. And so we'll need to wait a little while to see how all of these variables, how all of these effects flesh out.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about China, its economy, the fact that it has devalued its currency, its stock market has tumbled, as apparently has or is the U.S. stock market today, and obviously having some impacts in Europe as well, talking with Mauro Guillen and Jacques Delisle. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we're talking about China, its economy, the world. Jacques Delisle is with us, a professor of law, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, deputy director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China, also director of the Asia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia, and also with us, Mauro Guillen, professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Joseph H. Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. Bit of a mouthful, but we are learning a lot in this hour of Radio Times as history happens, or certainly news is happening. And again, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Jacques, you mentioned something earlier. I just wanted to pick up on it. It sounds like there has been a migration in China from the rural parts of China into the cities. Is that also sort of part of these dramatic changes that we're talking about?
It's part of the
urbanization, I guess.
Yeah, it's part of it connects to a lot of what we've been talking about. I mean, part of the way China sustained double-digit growth was just, I mean, classic development economics. You get people out of low-productivity agriculture, move them to the cities. And in China, that was largely a movement from the inland areas to the coastal areas, the kinds of cities we think of as producing all those imports that we buy. You know, the areas near Hong Kong, areas near Shanghai, that part, that's essentially the Gold Coast of China. Now, some of that got more complicated back during the global financial crisis. When the export market tanked in 2007, 2008, particularly 2008, what happened was a lot of those workers went back home. And some of them never moved back to the cities. Now, some of that was the kind of shift to a domestic consumption-oriented economy that we've talked about. Some of it was work in Chinese coastal factory towns is not all that pleasant. And, you know, you go back, you make less, but you also live a better life. And some of it is industry migrated inland to take advantage of cheaper costs there, although you incur some transportation costs, they're not necessarily ruinous. So some of that's been going on for a while. But the real story is China has now reached a level of development. It is a, you know, it is a middle-income country. Now, that has its own problems. A lot of countries get trapped at the middle-income level. But what it does mean is it's not just a cheap labor place anymore. And that's been part of the adjustment. Now, the good news is that gives you consumers. The bad news is it doesn't give you the kind of cheap labor that allows you to compete purely on price in export markets.
Well, I wanted to, Mauro, about just the impact of the tumbling cost of a barrel of oil. I think we're down to something like $30 or $40 a barrel, which is unheard of this time last year. Is that also a factor in what we're talking about here?
Well, of course it is, because China has been the most important purchaser of all sorts of commodities, including iron ore and soybeans and all sorts of things, minerals, agricultural commodities, and oil. And essentially, the slowdown of the Chinese economy means that the demand for those commodities has been coming down. And then the dollar, as you know, for a while also has been increasing in value for other relative to other currencies. So this has put a lot of downward pressure on commodity prices, and this has hurt essentially all of those countries, in particularly Latin America. Whose livelihoods essentially depend on the export of these commodities. So Brazil, Peru, Chile, and so on and so forth.
I remember doing a program about countries in Africa where there was so much investment from China to build roads, but also to get some of the natural resources. Is that affected, Jacques, at all?
Well,
has that changed?
To some extent. I mean, a lot of the Chinese presence in Africa was to extract natural resources. And much of the story has been China going into some places where the West wouldn't go, Sudan, places like that, partly because these are regimes that we don't want to deal with, partly because it's relatively high risk for companies to go into potentially unstable places, but also partly because the Chinese resource extraction companies were kind of late to the game. And China has, been willing to go into those areas. Partly they don't put as much kind of human rights and other such issues in their foreign policy. And partly these were the places that were still left to go in. And the Chinese resource extraction companies that go in, oil companies and others, they operate in a somewhat different space than the classic multinationals in their field. They have access to state capital. They're entangled with policy imperatives to make sure China's energy sources keep flowing. So there's a lot of politics to that side of it. But as Chinese demand drops, you know, there's going to be less need for those kinds of imports. A lot of the infrastructure building that goes on, some of that is essentially set up as development assistance. Some of it also is to benefit Chinese construction companies, which are internationally competitive on the mixture of price and quality, but which, you know, got more contracts than they otherwise would have because of the politics of the relationship with those countries.
Mauro, just how nervous should the world be?
Right now?
with what is going on in China. I mean, the world is very reactive, obviously. If we're talking about stock markets and what's going on in Europe and other parts of the world, should people be biting their nails because of what's going on in China?
People should be paying attention to what's going on in China. People in the United States or people in Europe, people outside of China itself. You cannot have a conversation about any topic of global significance these days, whether it is the economy or financial markets or even politics, without discussing China, right? I mean, this is the big difference compared to, let's say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So it is important. It is the second largest economy. It's the world's largest trading nation. And quite frankly, I think we should wish the Chinese a lot of luck in terms of managing this transition, because if something goes awfully wrong in China, that's going to drag the global economy, right? 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it didn't matter. But today, it does matter. So I think it is in our best interest. Well, I mean, there could be a meltdown of financial markets. There could be a major political crisis. There could be a popular unrest. I think the Tianjin explosion doesn't, help in this respect because it shows that, there's too much, familiarity, let's put it that way, between businesses and the government. And the government is not strong enough to intervene in these cases and to sort things out. So I think there's a lot of things to worry about. So we should be paying attention to it. Without paying attention to it, I don't think we would be able here in the United States or in Europe to make the right kinds of decisions, right, moving forward.
Is familiarity another name for corruption, Jacques Delisle? when Morrow talks about the familiarity between...
I'll let him talk about corruption.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Is that because I specialize in corruption? So no. Only as an observer, not a participant. The corruption problem is big in China, and one of the signal policies of the Xi Jinping leadership has been the most serious anti-corruption drive we've seen basically forever in the PRC, post-49 era. And so it's taken down some very big fish, people who were very close, Lin Jihua, very close to Hu Jintao, the prior leader. We saw Bo Xilai, although that started before the new leadership was fully in place. It was still part of the same general cluster of problems. We've seen senior people in the military. We've seen Zhou Yongkang, who was on the Politburo Standing Committee and was in charge of the political legal system. So, I mean, really big people going down. That is, only the tip of the iceberg. We've seen really a concerted effort to go after a lot of corruption. What we don't know yet is quite how effective it's going to be. And the jury is still out on whether there is some political bias to sort of which side you're on in the factional politics about how vulnerable you are. And the problem is that the close relatives of everybody all the way up the chain have done pretty well in business and indeed it's hard to unpack, as I think we've talked about on the show before, hard to unpack how much of that is people who are genuinely skilled and know how to work the system versus essentially payoffs. But there is a lot of corruption. Everybody recognizes it. And it's a drag on the economy. I mean, there was a time when corruption was functional because it got around the vestiges of the planning system and you could get resources allocated to more efficient uses by breaking the rules. And then for a while, it was just kind of a minor tax and you could deal with it. The sense now is that it is having more of an economic drag, and this gets back to Morrow's point, and it is eroding confidence in the government. Uh-huh. This is a government which has said, we are capable. We'll keep the growth rates up. We'll keep stability. We'll keep the gravy train rolling. And in return, trust us, don't muck around in politics. And when you get things like the Tianjin explosion, like the buildings that collapsed in the Sichuan earthquake several years ago, like the melamine milk poisoning, all of these things, like the stock market, where the government said, the stock market's only going to get better, pile in, and people did, and then it starts falling and they don't intervene to stop it, this level of trust question becomes a real issue. The gods have feet of clay. And that's going to be an issue, especially for somebody like Xi Jinping, who came to power as something of a populist. I mean, people really liked his image. They liked what he was doing. They liked going after corruption. And if you start turning out to be not quite so competent, and you've already gored a lot of entrenched interests, you start to be in a weaker position. Not a revolution, not overthrowing him, but it makes it harder to do some of the tough political tasks.
You're saying he ends up isolating himself?
Well, he has gathered an immense amount of power in his own hands. I mean, I think what has surprised a lot of China watchers is just how personally powerful he has become. Because we'd had sort of a declining clout of the top leader. I mean, Mao was Mao. Nobody else is going to be Mao. Deng Xiaoping was pretty close. But then each generation, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, you saw less and less power in the hands of the central leader. Indeed, to the point where Hu Jintao was held in some contempt for being a relatively weak head of the country. And the question was, would Xi Jinping stabilize that, maybe reverse it? So far, he has gone much farther than that. And so a huge amount of policy is now being made, not in the institutional structures where we foreigners get access and can find out what's going on. It's being done in these leading small groups. And Xi Jinping heads almost every one of them. The problem is, if you're doing everything, you're doing nothing, right? You can't make everything a top priority at once. And if something goes wrong, it's on you. Now, he's been very successful, and the top leadership has been very successful at what the Chinese call pointing the spear downward. It's not me. It's the guys down in Tianjin who messed up. It's not me. It's the guys in the stock market who messed up. Can you do that forever?
Right. And once they've been hauled off to wherever, then maybe you are left more by yourself.
Well, the joy of a party of tens of millions of people in a bureaucracy of hundreds of thousands even in fairly small quarters of bureaucracy means there's a lot of people you can blame for a long time. But it is a confidence problem that, again, there's no sign of revolution, but it is a real confidence problem that changes the game in Chinese politics.
And let's not forget that the Soviet Union was a very different kind of system. but it fell because of Chernobyl. You know, that could be Tianjin, right? The explosion there. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit. And then, of course, because Afghanistan, right? Well, China has problems in Tibet and in the Western provinces. I mean, there's terrorism every week. There's deaths every week. There's, you know, increasing problems. It's not the same as 25 years ago, 30 years ago in the Soviet Union. But there are issues, right, that they need to tackle.
And that's Mauro Guillen, who joins us with, along with Jacques Delisle. We are talking about what's happening inside China, what's the impact outside of China. And again, to join the conversation, any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. To you, Mauro, I'm curious about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this is being negotiated, but nonetheless, a trade agreement involving the Pacific Rim countries. Does what is happening in China, does that impact where that goes or how that works out? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't think the Trans-Pacific initiative is going to have such a large impact in any event, right? But I do believe that it may affect some of the calculations regarding that process, you know, what's going on now with China and how the Chinese economy does. And what is the U.S. attitude, right? We haven't talked, for example, about what is the Fed going to do in the wake of all of this, right? I mean, are they going to continue with their publicized plan to start increasing interest rates, as soon as, maybe a month or two, right?
Do you think the Fed will hold off on that?
Well, I think they will have, they're probably reconsidering their moves, right, in the wake of all of this. So there's all sorts, as you said at the beginning, I mean, the magic word here is interconnected, right? Everything is interconnected. So the Fed, is independent, but that doesn't mean it can do whatever it wants. It has to take into account all of these events, and especially, I think, what Jack was referring to in terms of the domestic situation in China.
Yeah.
They're probably studying that very, very carefully to see what might be their next move.
How do you see Europe? I mean, the sort of role that Europe plays as we talk. I mean, we've been focusing, obviously, largely on China, but in many ways on the United States as well. What about Europe in the middle?
Well, that's another source of instability right now. The Greeks just called an election. There's a lot of clouds about the economy over there. Austerity measures don't seem to be delivering what they were supposed to be delivering. And then on top of that, you have a major immigration crisis. We have no immigration crisis in this country, in spite of, everything that Trump is doing to try to create one. But there is a major immigration crisis in Europe, as you know.
Yes.
Italy rescued 1,000 people a day ago, right? From the Mediterranean. So the crisis over there is very severe, and it has many different aspects, right, ranging from financial aspects to monetary aspects, the economy and the immigration.
I'm thinking, too, Jacques, the Chinese president will be meeting with President Obama in September. It'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall there. What would you like them to be talking about?
Well, I don't think anybody's wish list is going to change the agenda at this point.
No.
One of the issues is there's so much on the table right now. So this is the economy issues we're talking about now are just the latest thing, and they're not the most crisis-laden thing because this is not an area where the U.S. and China have obvious fundamental disagreements. I mean, there are going to be various moves that either side can undertake that would be a mixture of good and bad. But as Mauro has underscored, it is now so complex that there are winners and losers both places no matter what you do. So that's a complicated interconnected trade-off. The other stuff that's on the table is more friction producing. So we've got the South China Sea island building and what China is up to there in a way that is worrying some of America's friends and allies in the region. The relationship with Japan has been quiet in recent months, but it's not like the underlying problems have been solved. And to get to the TPP issue, I think Mauro knows international business and economics better than I do, so I wouldn't traipse on that. But I would say that what we do see going on here is a question of the politics of the competing trade agreements. The WTO has really petered out as a way of moving forward with trade liberalization. The Doha round stalled, and it's been on life support ever since. So the action has shifted to these regional trade agreements. And here we have another one of those ambiguities. We were talking about earlier whether the renminbi devaluation is a step toward markets or an intervention to goose the economy. Well, the same thing's true here. China used to say the TPP is the ABC, the Anyone But China Agreement. And that's partly on the U.S., because we sold it as a who's going to set the rules for the 21st century trade regime. But China has softened and said it would like in. But China at the same time is setting up its own regional comprehensive economic partnership. It's setting up the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is kind of like the World Bank, the BRICS New Development Bank. So these institutions, China is saying, these are supplementing. These are filling gaps because the U.S. hasn't allowed reform in the major institutions. We're playing by the rules. We're trying to help. But the suspicion is it's like the darker reading of renminbi devaluation. It's about trying to set up a contrary system, and it really is a context. So all that stuff's going to be on the table. Add to that cybersecurity and cyber espionage. And I think the big underlying story here, and this is more political, is that really for the first time since the U.S. and China normalized relations in 1979, there are serious, still minority, but serious voices in U.S. policy circles saying it's time for a big rethink of the relationship. Now, that hasn't become the dominant narrative, but it's not been this strong in living memory, basically since the normalization happened.
And who are they, and what are they saying?
Well, I mean, they're saying is basically that the U.S. and China are following the dynamics that you sometimes see with rising powers and relatively declining powers. That basically, China and the U.S. have a relationship which may not be dependably basically cooperative as it has been for the last 30-some years, but that basically we've got a rising power that will challenge the U.S. for supremacy and pursue a very different agenda because of ideological and political differences. There's high international relations theory about this, but it's now seeped into the policy think tank world. And so there was Ashley Tullis and Blackwell wrote this piece, which has been getting a lot of attention, that says it's not containment, but a lot of people are reading it as sounding like it's containment.
Interesting. Well, let's take another very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about China, what's been happening inside China, its economy, its financial situation, its impact on the rest of the world, including the United States. And that's Jacques Delisle. He's a professor of law, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, also deputy director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China. Mauro Guillen is with us as well, professor of international management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He directs the Joseph H. Lauder Institute of Management and International Studies. So if you ever had a question or a comment, these are the guys to talk to. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Very important topic we're talking about, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mauro Guillen and Jacques Delisle about China, about China's economy, its currency devaluation, that impact on their stock market, also on the rest of the world as well. Looks like we've got a bunch of callers coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Mauro, just to you, this is something we're talking about during the break. China still holds a lot of American debt. So I just wanted to fold that into our conversation. Does what's happening in China change that at all?
Well, that's relevant because obviously the United States has a continuing need to finance its deficit. But let's not forget that China is not the only foreign holder of U.S. debt. In fact, Japan holds as much as China does. And then you also have Britain, and you have Germany, and you have many other kinds of investors from pretty much all over the world holding U.S. debt.
We have an email from Tony. Says, please ask your guests to say more about China's goal of establishing the world's new reserve currency. I've read that when and if the dollar is replaced as the world's reserve currency, whether by the yuan or by the euro, the U.S. can kiss its 2+ centuries of world economic domination goodbye. You guys are pointing at each other.
I'll let Mauro speak to U.S. global domination.
Go ahead. And then, Jacques, you're not going to escape this. No, go ahead.
Well, the U.S. dollar displaced pound sterling as the world's reserve currency back in the 1920s. And it became the key currency in the global system after World War II. Now, even with the relative decline of the United States, and even assuming that China continues to do well, the Chinese currency will be, a minor international currency, if it manages to become risk. Because essentially what China lacks is transparency. We don't have confidence in them. They don't have a track record. They don't speak English. They don't have the rule of law. Investors, if they want to hold huge amounts of money in a reserve currency, they want to have access to all of those institutions so that they are confident, they have trust. So the dollar will continue to be the leading reserve currency in the world for a long time. Having said that, the dollar cannot continue to play as large a role as it has over the last 50 years forever. Right, that's the issue. And that, by the way, also introduces an element of volatility in the market, because we know that the U.S. can no longer play that big role, but there's nothing to replace the dollar, right? There's nothing else, really. And this creates a big problem for investors.
You want to add to that, Jacques?
Yeah, I think in the short term, the dollar's done well, not because it's so great, because everything else is so terrible, right? So there's been this flight into dollars, and the question is, if that's no longer true, you'll see more of that downward pressure. But on the Chinese specific issue, it's a great question from your emailer. This has been an important Chinese goal, and the most benevolent reading, or the most benign reading of the devaluation, is that it was a necessary, although not sufficient, step to getting the renminbi into the IMF, the International Monetary Fund's basket of SDR, special drawing right currencies, which is an important marker for being an international reserve currency. Countries will borrow when they get into trouble in that version. Now, one of the funny things about the renminbi is, if you look at the numbers, a huge amount of international trade is now done in renminbi, and an increasing amount of financial flows are done in renminbi. But there is a ceiling there. Almost all of those are transactions that involve a Chinese party. And when you get to be a true reserve currency, a really major world currency, it's when you're in third-party transactions. So trade between Canada and Brazil may be in U.S. dollars. It's not in renminbi. Where you see the renminbi being used is in those many, many transactions that do involve China. And breaking through that ceiling requires a lot of change. And Mauro pointed to the key elements. To that, one can add deep financial markets and just having it behave in many ways like the dollar does. And confidence, he spoke to confidence. One piece of confidence here is confidence the government won't intervene to manipulate the exchange rate. And the problem with this latest signal is, again, it's pro-market, but it's manipulative. Mm.
But is the goal of the Chinese government to get that kind of legitimacy for its currency?
It is a stated goal. It is partly a political badge of pride, but there also are economic benefits. The U.S. has done very, very well by having the dollar be an international reserve currency. There are all sorts of advantages that come with that. Now, the renminbi, part of why it's been so successful is it's been pegged to the dollar effectively. So it's essentially a shadow dollar for those purposes.
But it sounds like what you were saying, Mauro, about the dollar is still the reserve currency, is that it's not going to be the way it was 20 or 30 years ago, where there was this sort of domination that we had. Well, does that mean more volatility, more things like we've been talking about?
Yes, because
now
we're going through a transition. I mean, remember, the United States was more than 50% of the global economy at the end of World War II, and today is less than 20%. Right. And essentially, we're making a big effort. We're getting a lot of advantages out of it, lower interest rates among them, because of having the reserve currency that everybody wants to use in the world. But there's a limit as to how much we can keep on playing that dominant role when the U.S. is now much smaller as an economy.
Let me see what Josh from Fraser has to say. Josh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi, Josh.
I was hoping your panel might be able to shed a little bit of light and expertise on the subject of rare earth metals. These are things that our electronic systems are built around, and China holds the vast supply of the world's rare earth. And I was wondering how this affects trade policy, but also how it might affect something like cybersecurity, as it's sort of like, if oil is to energy, what rare earths are to our digital system. So I'll take my youth-based responses off the air.
Josh, thanks for the call. I'm tossing that to Jacques Delisle.
China does have a 90%+ share. I think the last number is 94 or 96, something like that, in the global production of rare earths, which are essential to all the computer electronics, as your caller says. And this has been a political issue before. When China-Japan relations were in the tank a couple of years ago, partly over the island disputes, China threatened to disrupt rare earth supplies to Japan. And given Japan's place in the global production chain for computer-based electronics, that was a big, big deal. Now, there are ways of legally, properly limiting exports, and China tried to defend the possibility of restricting exports on the grounds of shortages and such. The WTO didn't buy that. This is a concern. It is a choke point. Now, that's not that there are no rare earths anyplace else. It's just that it's much cheaper to produce them in China, and China has a lot of the supply. If the world is convinced the tap will be turned off, then you'll start seeing investments to reopen rare earth supply sources elsewhere, just as, you know, you see new oil resources come on in the wake of the oil embargoes back in the 70s and 80s. So there is an adjustment there, but it's a slow adjustment, and this is a fast-moving economic sector. And, you know, but it sort of winds up cutting both ways. One of the reasons that China's current policy moves we've been talking about may not help goose exports very much in the long run is because those companies that – those foreign companies, multinationals that fled China aren't going to go back just because of the temporary drop in their RMB. What if it goes back up, right? So these are sticky things and the transitions are costly. But there are political costs to turning off the tap on something rare earths. That would be seen as a strategic move that would be very upsetting.
Do you want to add to that more?
Well, and if we were talking about generating more confidence in their currency, if China makes a move to limit the export of rare earths, that's going to undermine confidence. So, you know, they have to be very careful as to how they pursue each of these, you know, policies and interests.
I mean, how much fighting, I guess, sort of within the Chinese government or even within China itself over what kind of country do we want to be? How do we want our currency to be viewed by the rest of the world?
Well, you know, those things are sometimes hard to figure out even in a democracy now that we've been watching what's going on in our own politics. But it's, of course, much more opaque in China. And, you know, it is a hard set of signals to read. There is no doubt that this leadership came to power saying and I think believing that the continued success of China economically and the next step in China's economic development and in its role in the world was to take some pretty tough medicine, to really make the moves that are necessary to take the third and fourth waves of reform, to marketize, to in some sense expose themselves to forces they've been relatively well shielded from. But that's tough because there are entrenched interests. Many of them are state-linked enterprises. Many of them are people who've done pretty well under the system. And, you know, that's goring a lot of pretty powerful oxen. And it's tough to do. And one of the challenges that Xi Jinping faces is he's going after all the party and state people who are potentially at risk for corruption charges. He's alienated some of the pro-market reform intellectuals by going too slow. He has alienated liberal intellectuals by, you know, jailing rights protection lawyers, by talking about how you shouldn't be learning Western subjects, Western content in the university. So, you know, you're going after all those at once. He's kind of run out of backers. Now, again, it's not a democracy. He's not going to get voted out of office. It's a very formidable and stable system in many ways. But it's sort of who's in the coalition now. And as the economy hits the skids, some of that populist element that's been buoying him starts to erode a little bit, too.
We have an email from Adam says, China has always claimed that Taiwan belongs to them. Would an economic downturn in China lead to military action in the Chinese Sea? I'm back to you,
Let's
Jacques
hope not.
Certainly
one of the growing props, one of the growing sources of legitimacy over the last many years, it's not just Xi Jinping, it goes back, you know, quite some time, and in some ways goes all the way back to the beginnings of the revolution, has been a nationalist credibility for the regime. And in the transition from the prior leadership to the current Xi Jinping leadership, much of the criticism of the prior guys was they were too soft in standing up for China's national interests. China should behave like a great power. And there's a lot of nationalist rhetoric. That said, I think we're well short of a credible argument for a diversionary war. But it does increase the risk of the frictions that are out there escalating. Mm-hmm. Taiwan's actually been a relative bright spot. It's been the brightest spot in China's external – China wouldn't call it foreign – external relations. You know, compared to the tensions in the South China Sea with the Philippines and Vietnam and other U.S. Friends and allies, or the tensions with Japan, Taiwan's been very successful. The problem is Taiwan's economy is now so deeply entwined with the mainland that if things go badly on the mainland, that starts being bad for Taiwan economically.
Oh, interesting. We have an email from Ron. We in the USA have the impression that much of the big business in China is owned and run by the Chinese government. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Mauro.
Absolutely. Especially in certain industries, right? When you're talking about financial services, infrastructure, construction, oil,
telecommunications,
those industries are essentially pretty much still dominated by state-owned firms.
You know, Jacques, I was thinking about those, and perhaps it was around the Olympics or something, but those gigantic infrastructure projects, and you hear about what feels like almost whole cities being built and highways and I guess rail as well. Is that still continuing in China, these gigantic infrastructure projects?
They still go on. And, you know, China does need a lot of infrastructure.
It's a big place, right?
Right. It's a big place, and it's a fast-developing place and had been an underdeveloped place. So a lot of what the infrastructure investment has gone into makes a great deal of sense. I mean, high-speed rail among major cities so you don't have to rely on airports. Airports to cities that have been growing quickly, mm-hmm. roads, all that sort of stuff makes a great deal of sense. You know, the U.S. and China couldn't possibly be more different in the emphasis they're putting on building or rebuilding infrastructure. The downside on the infrastructure investment in China is really twofold. As we said earlier, some of it is that some of it's been wasteful. There are roads to nowhere. There are apartment buildings that have nobody in it. There are empty cities. Now, yeah, it's probably not a huge percentage of the investment overall, but it is right. deadweight loss. The other thing is the more you rely on that, that's sort of the drug that keeps you from taking the hit to convert to a consumer-based economy. I mean, they're basically, you know, basic economics. There's government spending, right, which consists, in the Chinese case, mostly of infrastructure investment. There's exports, which is what has been declining, and they've occasionally tried to goose up. And there's consumption. I mean, that's really the bulk of it. There's private investment as well. And there are a lot of Chinese firms that are private now. But, you know, in China, it's a spectrum. Separating what is state-owned, state-linked, and truly private is a very messy business, and I can tell you it doesn't track the legal categories very nicely.
Well, we're almost out of time here. I'm looking at the clock and looking at you as well, Mauro. And apparently today in China, stocks fell 8%. We're sort of watching what's on our screen here, some ups and downs here in the U.S. What will you be looking for, let's say, over the next couple of weeks, maybe even next couple of months?
Well, regarding the stock market, you know, I always make the assumption it goes up and it comes down, and it's very difficult to predict. And as you very well know, it's very difficult to beat the market. So you need to think about, you know, what is it that you want to accomplish? Let's not engage in speculation. Let's not borrow money and invest in the stock market. That's crazy. That's what a lot of Chinese households have been doing, and therefore they're in big trouble now. And think about the stock market as one asset class, as one option that you have for investing your money. And think, you know, with a long time horizon, if you possibly can. And don't make any crazy decisions. Don't try to get your money out at the first sign of trouble, because that could prove to be actually the silliest decision that you make in your life, right? So you've got to, you know, like sit back, relax a little bit, and think that the stock market is a difficult game to play, and it's very difficult to beat the market. And what you need to do is to, you know, diversify, think rationally, take a breath, and, you know, get some good advice also. Right?
I also wonder, as you look at China, I mean, what will you be looking for? And this might be something that others could be looking for as well.
Well, what goes on with the government? And Jacques has given us some, you know, very good ideas as to what are the kinds of things that are important to watch. Mm-hmm. But also, I think quite importantly, is what are the kinds of decisions that they make regarding the currency in the next few days? And more importantly, what goes on with their trading relationships in Asia and with Europe and the United States? I hope that this doesn't degenerate into a currency war. Mm-hmm. I hope that this doesn't degenerate into what you know brought about the Great Depression, which is that everybody started to adopt protectionist measures. So today you cannot establish tariffs because everybody's committed to you know tariff reduction, but you can certainly manipulate currencies. And let's not forget that over the last 6 years, pretty much every country in the world has manipulated its currency. That includes the Europeans, that includes the Swiss, that includes the Japanese, that includes the Brazilians, the Americans, us, and now the Chinese, right? So we're all, you know, like trying to play this game, and it's a dangerous one.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Jacques.
I think the real question is to read what's going on with the leadership here. The most benevolent reading is this is taking advantage of a bad situation to try to do the right thing, moving to markets. Another reading is that they have inside information that they're in deep trouble, that we don't know they are. Another is they're skittish. Another is they're not really committed to market reforms. And another is they're just control freaks. And if you can figure out which one of those is right, you can make a lot even in the Shanghai stock market.
Well, but are you saying also time will tell?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It's just too soon.
It's just too soon. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Jacques DeLisle, thank you very much. Professor of Law, Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, also Deputy Director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China. Mauro Guillen, thank you very much as well. Professor of International Management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where he directs the Joseph H. Lauder Institute. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. program, including how to download a podcast of the program, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.